Hi, this is Terry Kuzma, Penn State University. I'd like to go over some notes today. We're going to look at materials and nanotechnology for ESI 213. We're going to go over Unit 8, the plasma removal process, so we can take a look at the outline. So this is a continuation of our discussion that we had on the previous presentation, and we're going to talk a little bit more in detail about sidewall passivation and what it does for us. So sidewall passivation can be used in an etch process to control the sidewall profile. So in some ways, it's like a pseudo mask that gets applied to the sidewall of the etch profile in real time. So it's a debris from the process, and the debris, you engineer to have that debris on the sidewall so that it can actually coat the sidewall as you etch. So film forms on the sidewalls, preventing the material from being etched isotropically. The film is actually a polymer that's formed from the process gases and a photoresist layer on the substrate. And this makes the assumption that photoresist is the mask of choice, which it is most of the time. The polymers are basically combinations of carbon and hydrogen, and they can contain oxygen and nitrogen and other etch byproducts. Polymer chemistry depends on the process conditions. So really, it's just a function of whatever's in the plasma, the byproducts, the volatile etch products that are in the plasma, the incoming gases, they mix together to form this film on the sidewall. So it's kind of a collage of different materials. Specific gases can also be added to the recipe to ensure passivation film formation. So not only can you count on the debris from the process being used as this passivation layer, but by design, you can implement additional gases, additional feed gases, or the concentration of the feed gases to promote this film formation on the sidewalls. So this is a nice little cartoon of what we're doing so that you can picture this in your mind. So we have our, you know, typical etch profile here, like the little rectangle that's in that substrate. So the substrate shown in the gray. And what we have here is the photoresist that's on the top. So that's shown in the red. Delineated with the word photoresist. And this really isn't a scale. That photoresist is probably huge with respect to the size of the trench. So typically the photoresist would be a number of microns thick, and typically the substrate, the profile would be nanometers deep. So the photoresist is actually very, very thick. And as you can see on the sidewalls, as we etch down, there's that gold film, so shown right here, the gold area. And this is the film formers that are on the sidewall. So this provides a sidewall passivation. So as you etch down into the trench, the residual gas, the feed gas, the volatile products can mix together, and they actually form a skin, a layer on the sidewall. So that's like a pseudo mask. And what that does, it prevents the chemistry, which is shown by this icon. The chemistry comes and it literally wants to attack the gray material, the substrate, but it has that protective layer on there shown in the gold. So that's what allows this sidewalls not to be attacked chemically. Naturally, what we have in here is also in our plasma, if we assume that we have this substrate negatively charged, we'll have the ions coming straight down. And the ions come down, for the most part, fairly laminar. And what they'll do is they have a lot of energy at the bottom, so they can actually make or break bonds down at the bottom. They have enough energy. But since they're coming down fairly laminar, if they go off the sidewalls on an angle, naturally they don't possess that full energy. So they don't have enough energy to knock a lot of this polymer loose, and they basically glide off the sidewalls and careen down into the bottom of the trench. So the bottom of the trench sees a lot of energy. It sees the laminar flow of the ions, and it also sees the chemistry. Whereas the sidewalls don't see the direct contact of the incoming ions, and they also don't see the direct contact of the radicals because we have the film formers on there. So this allows us to create moderately straight 90-degree profiles in a substrate. Of course, they're never 90 degrees, they're 80-some degrees. So the sidewall, the polymers coats the sidewalls and act as a pseudo mask. And I just made that word up. So that's a fake mask. It's not the same mask as on the surface, the photoresist. So it's a real-time protective mask. Irons, for the most part, strike vertically and remove polymer bottom at the bottom of the etch and not at the sidewall because they're coming on a glancing angle. And the sidewall polymers, after we're done with our etch, they're removed using an oxygen and plasma at a rather high pressure, maybe typically from 500 to 750 millitor. And what this does is it uses a lot of chemistry, a lot of oxygen in our process, and very little bombardment. And what that'll do is act as a wet etch type removal system to alleviate the sidewalls from that polymer buildup. So now we'll take a look at, you know, in our outline, we'd like to look at some common chemistries that are used for some common materials. And there's all kind of materials that you could use. These ones are very popular because they're widely available, inexpensive, etc. So controlled etch process by balancing the chemistry. So in the etch process, we choose the correct chemistries to increase the etch rate. Increasing the mean free path of the plasma by decreasing the pressure also increases the etch rate, and this will add in uniformity. Combining chemistry and bombardment will produce an etch rate that's greater than either contributor alone. And combining chemistry and bombardment allows the profile to be tuned between isotropic and anisotropic. The etch profile can also be enhanced with sidewall passivation. So, in a nutshell, that's what we're trying to do. These are some examples of sidewall chemistries and materials that we would like to etch. So, in the left-hand column, we have the material. So, it's typical to etch a lot of popular, you know, silicon dioxide or polysilicon aluminum. So, the chemistry is shown in the next grid. The volatile product that's relieved from the surface, and then we can show the sidewall material that's on the polymer containing material that's on the sidewall in the last column there. As the assumption here is that we get a lot of carbon, I guess, from the photoresist. Here's some common etch gases that we use quite a bit. So these are the go-to gases. If you go look at a lot of dry etch tools, these would be the common gas bottles that would be on the back of the machine or in the service aisleway or in a gas cabinet. So we have the Freon families, the carbon-containing fluorine groups right there. So there's the chemical name and the common name and the formula shown. We also use quite a bit. A popular gas is sulfur hexafluoride. And what we would use that for is kind of like a wet type etch. We would mostly mix that with oxygen a lot to tie up the sulfur. So we would form SO. And then we would have a lot of free fluorine in our process so that we could do a wet etch type profile. An interesting gas is NF3. NF3, probably the first thing that comes to my mind is it's really dangerous. So NF3 is a very, very poisonous gas at very small amounts, so please look up the MSDS if you're ever using that type system. It's moderately difficult to detect. A common theme now is to change the NF3 to an HF, mix it with hydrogen and change it to an HF acid and then detect the HF, so it has some difficulty being detected. And what we use that for quite a bit, and as you can see from the chemistry, if we would put this in a plasma, we can form N2 plus 6 fluorines. So basically the nitrogen goes away or is a volatile compound at that point, and then there's a tremendous amount of fluorine in there. So this would be, and it's really an enabling gas. This is an important gas in industry. What they use NF3 for is they would use that to clean process chambers. So between production runs, when they're doing a line of products, every so many products, like every 100 products that go through the system, what you might do is run a dummy substrate through there, a non-product substrate to, you know, place in the chamber. And then you'd run a plasma with NF3. And what that would do is basically scour the chamber and clean the chamber out so that the chamber isn't contaminated. So an issue in dry etching and a lot of material processing is after a while you build up debris in the chamber, which causes contamination. So this is a gas that they use for self-cleaning in the chamber, and this allows the preventative maintenance schedule to be extended. So it's a really, really important gas. So those machines in industry are basically printing money, right? They're making a product, And so you want them to print that product as often as you can without the downtime. So this NF3, you know, keeps the uptime of the machine at a high level. So there's other gases here that we use commonly. A lot of times, you know, a rule of thumb, just a big rule of thumb, and certainly this could be broken. When we use fluorine gases, typically that would be for dielectric materials. And when we would use chlorine or bromine type gases, they would be for conductive materials like metals or so. Now, that certainly could be broken if we would look at titanium, et cetera. But the rule of thumb is that's what we would do, and it works most of the time. The gases down here, these are gases that we would often add to a process a lot of times. So helium we would use as a buffer gas. And what this would allow us to do is maybe control the reaction rate. Helium has a high heat capacity, so that could extend our rate. It would also keep, per se, the chemical activity of the gas alive longer. So what it would do is separate chemical species so that they don't recombine in a more inert state. So we could use that as an additive gas. Nitrogen is used quite a bit in the same phase. Oxygen is used quite a bit, you know, certainly for its chemical capacity. But a lot of times what we would do, as I alluded to before, we might take oxygen and mix it with sulfur, SF6. And what that can do is kind of tie up this sulfur to allow the fluorine to do its business. So typically that's what we could do also with, if we were using CF4, we would take the oxygen and in some simple way that would tie up the carbon, and then we would allow our fluorine to be freed. So that's a typical methodology that's used quite a bit. So here's some materials and typical etchants that we would use for those materials. And, you know, it's a long list, but I can let you review those at will so you can take a look at that. And now we'll move on in the presentation. An interesting part, a dynamic part of the presentation, is to analyze recipe parameters and the resultant etch profiles. So what we would like to do in this section is review a lot of the things that we've used and a lot of the major things that happen in an etch. So the major players in etch, the major energy that take place, we're going to look at those and put that on one graph. And what we can do is, or at least the objective of this exercise is, we would like to say, where are our control knobs on our system and what would the profile look like in our substrate? So what we want to develop is a chart. And I call it the egg chart because the egg chart is like a zone. So if you're in the egg, if you're in that zone, you should be able to predict what type of profile that you'll get in that zone. So these things, this chart is not exact, but it's a good guesstimate of what is going to happen. So this is an analytical model. It's a graphical representation of various process parameters. The y-axis represents the bombardment energy. So that's the big B that I talked about before. The x-axis represents the chemical energy, so that's the C. So we have B star C, and then the dogleg boundary, which we'll show you on the graph, that's the polymer. So what we're going to analyze basically is this equation, chemistry interacting with bombardment plus polymerization. So for an ideal anisotropic etch, the required zone resembles an egg in the middle of the chart, which we'll show on the next slide. There are other factors that determine the etch profile that are not included in this exercise. We'll look at these parameters after we look at this first iteration analysis. So we'll add some ideas that will help us fine-tune where we are in the egg. So the egg chart, a chart like this can be found and or generated for any dry etchable material. So for our example, we're going to look at this chart for SiO2. So this is just an example. We could do this for titanium, we could do this for aluminum, we could do this for a lot of different materials. Naturally, this chart is not exact, but could use as a starting point for building an etch recipe. So this allows you an estimate to go in and look at things. So the oxide etch chart considerations, we want to look at the fluorine to carbon ratio. We call that the FC ratio. We want to increase the DC bias, and when we increase the DC bias, this would be going higher on our y-axis. This increases the bombardment. What we'll show on this chart is the addition of hydrogen And again, this is one of our passivation gases we add to the chamber. This will increase the polymerization. So this will add to the carbon and form some CH type materials. The addition of oxygen to the chamber increases the free fluorine. And what this allows us to do is tie up the carbon in our process and again, increase the free fluorine concentration. And then the thing that we want to look at is the aspect ratio, the depth or width for a small gap, trench, or hole. And that's what we're going to try to do is we're going to try to make, at least, you know, figurative in our head, we're going to try to make different etch profiles, different aspect ratio. So here's where we are. We're on this chart. And if we examine this chart, we might as well, one of the first things we want to do is look at the axes. So let's look at the axes here. So we'll look at the y-axis. And the y-axis shows us that we're looking at the DC bias. So down at the bottom, and there's no real numbers, but we're going to say that that's low or zero bombardment. And as we go up in the chart on the y-axis, as we go towards the top of the chart, we're going to say this is very high bombardment. So the energy is very high at the top and very low at the bottom. Then we want to look here at the x-axis, and we start out on the x-axis, and we're going to say the fluorine, the carbon ratio, the FC ratio, is shown right here. So if we would take fluorine, four fluorines, and divide it by carbon, if we take a look at that, we're going to get the number 2. Again, if we would take a look at the 6 divided by 2, we're going to get an FC ratio of 3. And if we look at this 4-to-1 ratio, we're going to get a ratio of 4. So basically, this shows us the bombardment on this axis and the chemistry on this axis. So now we have to look at the polymerization. As we can see on the left side of this dog leg curve is shown in the pink in this area. This is the polymerization, and this is where polymer builds up on the bottom of the trench. And it builds up naturally more rapidly as we have less bombardment energy. So we can see that the curve swings out down here at the bottom because we have less bombardment energy. And as we have more bombardment energy, then the polymer takes a beating on the bottom of the trench. So what we're looking at on this chart is also the addition of oxygen. So oxygen, what that's going to do when we add oxygen in our mass flow controllers to our process, what that's going to do is tie up our carbon and allow more free fluorine. So for example, if we take oxygen and if say we would do something like, and we're not going to balance the equation, I'm just figuratively, if we would mix this with C2F4, we could say some of these oxygens are going to tie up some of these carbons. So what we're basically doing is subtracting some of this carbon, and it would shift that to look like maybe CF4. Or maybe it would shift it to look more like C4F10 or C2F6. So as we add oxygen, we kind of shift the relative fluorine concentration to the right. Again, when we look add another gas in our process gases, we can actually add hydrogen. And when we add hydrogen, we can kind of tie up the fluorine and shift the polymer this way. So that's interesting that we're modifying these gases. And, the moral of the story here is, or the bottom line is, as we have if we have a feed gas on the system, like CF4, we can actually have CF4 look like and act like C2F6 by adding a little bit of hydrogen. And we can have something like C2F4 look like CF4 if we add some oxygen. So we can shift these gases and shift the process by these feed gas additions. So this is what we're going to take a look at. And now what we'd like to examine, and maybe what's caught your eye is, you know, what the heck is this yellow circle in here? And the yellow circle is the zone or the egg. It looks like an egg. And this egg would be the point that we would like to address, that we would have a profile in our substrate that would look like that, geometrically. So what we want to say is, what can we do? What process parameters would we have to make this happen? So I would say, here's my bombardment axis, and here's my chemistry axis. So basically what I'm saying is, to create this geometric profile, which is an anisotropic rectangle in our surface, what we would like to have is a moderate amount of bombardment and an FC ratio of about 2. And we would like to have polymers coating the sidewall, but not so much that it's going to form on the bottom. So this egg is close to this boundary value of polymer formation, but it's to the right. So you can see that polymers are not going to form on the bottom of the trench that much, but there's probably enough polymer around that's going to form on the sidewalls here and allow us to have this anisotropic etch. So that's what we want to do. We want to take a look at different zones in this map. So we might want to take a look over here, a look here, a look here. You know, in these different areas, what are we going to produce when we examine these process parameters? So what we want to do is examine chemistry interacting with bombardment and the addition of polymer, and what is that going to do with us? So if we had a small C interacting with a huge B and maybe the polymer doesn't exist, then certainly that's going to give us a certain type of profile. So that's the things that we want to take a look at. So let's look at the area number one on our chart that's in that egg zone. So we can say to be in the egg is to achieve the ideal anisotropic etch. So a lot of engineers think that, you know, this geometric profile is certainly something that's very valuable. So that's what they would use to make memory devices, a lot of sensors, etc. And just like a carpenter, people like to build things with rectangles and squares so they can overlap nicely, etc. So it's difficult to build things with spheres per se. So, you know, a lot of engineers like to build things with that geometric shape. So we'll call that the ideal anisotropic etch profile. So again, as we examined our chart, the FC ratio is approximately 2. This is an equal mixture of hydrogen and oxygen to provide polymerization and etch. And the DC bias level is just enough to give you enough bombardment to remove things on the bottom. So this is our ideal profile that we're trying to achieve. So let's take a look at that again and review. So in etch area number one, if we would take a look at these parameters, we can say this is what the bombardment is, this is what the chemistry is, and then we can estimate that we're having a little bit of polymer because we're near this zone where polymers build up on the bottom. So in that area, if we would adjust our DC bias and if we would adjust our FC ratio to be at that level, then we should be pretty well assured that we're going to have a etch profile that would be anisotropic in shape. And from there, we can move lower in the recipe, higher in the recipe, shift the recipe to the right, shift the recipe to the left. Again, we'll move that a little bit depending on our results. You know, you take your etch profile, place it in FESEM, see what you have, and then you could adjust your recipe parameters from there. So let's take a look at this chart again and say sidewall profile number 2. So what we're going to do is, you know, don't look at the chart. Let's imagine this in our head. This has low DC bias with little or no bombardment. So this is going to be our y-axis. So low DC bias is going to put us on the bottom of that chart. So it put us on the lower portion of that chart. No hydrogen, which means no polymerization. So that's going to mean that we're to the right of the chart. A lot of oxygen can increase etching. We're going to have an FC ratio of about 4. So that's going to the right side of the chart on the x-axis. And the aspect ratio is less than 1. We're going to expect a isotropic etch profile. We're down in this zone here. So our bombardment is very small, like a little b. So we're in this region, little b. Our chemistry here, because we're to the right, our chemistry is huge. That's a big C. And our polymer, here's the polymer over here. This is really devoid of polymer. So our equation is going to look like this. It's going to be big chemistry interacting with a little bombardment. And then our polymer is not going to be existent. So basically, we look at just these energy profiles. We're going to say we have a lot of chemistry, hardly any bombardment, and no polymer. Then you could say that basically that's going to be like a wet etch. And that's what it turns out to be. So we can estimate, you know, given those etch parameters, that our profile is going to look at like that. And again, this is an estimate, and it's a zone. But that's for zone number 2, giving these profiles or this analysis of where we are in the chart, we're going to wind up with profile number two. Let's take a look at profile number three. This is low DC buy. So again, bombardment is going to be very small. A lot of hydrogen, which is a lot of polymer. No oxygen, no etch. And we're going to have the FC ratio to be like 1/3. So we're not going to form much SiF4 as a volatile etch product. So we're going to be in the bottom left-hand corner of the chart. So this is where we are with our analysis. And we can see the polymer is building up because we're right here on the left. We can see the bombardment is very low. So our bombardment, well, let's start out with chemistry. Chemistry is really small. Let's interact that with our bombardment. What's our bombardment? Very small. What's our polymer? So our polymer is really big at that point. So we can expect we're not going to dig into the substrate that much. We're probably going to build up polymer on the surface. This is what our result of our experiment would look like. We would just build up polymer on the surface. So I hope this makes sense to you. What we're trying to do is look at these three energy vectors, chemistry, bombardment, and polymer, and see how they impact the magnitude of these different energies would impact our etching. So this is a very small C, a very small B, and a huge P. And what that's going to look like is just polymer buildup. So really, that's can't think of really any good use for that unless we were coating our sample with polymer. So let's take a look at another portion on our chart, sidewall number four. This has high DC buy, so we're going to be in the top portion of our graph on the y-axis. No hydrogen, which means no polymerization, so which we're going to be on the right side of our graph on the x-axis. A lot of oxygen, high etch rate. The FC ratio of about 4, again, we're going to be on the right side of the chart, so the aspect ratio is going to be greater than 1. So let's take a look. We're up in this region right here. So our bombardment is going to be huge. It's a big B. We're going to interact that with our chemistry. Our chemistry is big, too. And our polymer at this point, here's our polymer formation over here. Our polymer is going to be kind of 0. So we have a lot of chemistry, a lot of bombardment, but our sidewalls aren't protected because our polymer doesn't exist. So the chemistry is going to be able to nibble away at the walls. They're not going to be straight. And we're going to have a lot of bombardment. So what's that's going to give us? Well, this is a rough estimation of what's going to happen. So, you know, again, this is just a cartoon, you know, an academic cartoon. Certainly these sidewalls would probably be more sloped or something. But what this is going to show us is this because of the high bombardment, the high energy from the B, it's probably going to be deeper than it's wide because we have the synergy of B and C at this level. And then we only have the chemistry on the sidewall. So naturally, we're going to have a high aspect ratio. And the aspect ratio here is 2. So it's going to look something like that. And again, I don't think it would be square sidewalls like this. You know, this is just drawn in Microsoft Paint or something. But it would be similar to this type of profile. So I hope everybody's getting the idea here. What we want to do is, you know, we're interacting these energy vectors, adjusting their magnitude, and then saying, what would that give us, what would the resultant substrate profile look like? So this would give us an idea of what would happen in that area of number 4. So let's take a sidewall look at number 5 here on our chart again, just to review what we're doing. High DC bias, high bombardment, a lot of hydrogen makes a lot of polymer, no oxygen, no etch rate. So we're not going to form a lot of SiF4 because our FC ratio is small. The aspect ratio is going to be greater than 1, maybe, I don't know. So let's take a look at this region up here, number 5. I don't know if it would form this or not. It depends. You know, the polymer is going to be so dominant, but what you might see is these little islands in here would produce jagged features. And sometimes, depends on the discussion, but they would call this straw. So there would be jagged features in the bottom of the sidewalls because the polymer would be building up relative to that point. Usually at that side, this probably would coat over with polymer and stop the etch rate or something, given that thing. Again, this is just a rough estimate and saying what would happen in that area. Sidewall profile number 6, medium DC bias, no hydrogen, so no polymer, a lot of oxygen, high etch rate, FC ratio of about 4. Let's take a look at what happens over here at number 6. and you might estimate wider and deeper than profile number one due to increased bombardment. So this one would be a little bit more isotropic, rounded profile kind of thing. And again, these are just, you know, estimates of what would happen. So I think it's an interesting exercise to take a look at these different geometric shapes and where they would exist. Number seven is an exercise, medium DC bias, a lot of hydrogen, no oxygen, FC ratio of 4. Let's take a look over here at number 7. Again, because there's so much polymer, you really wouldn't run this exercise, but maybe something like this. I don't know. This one is, you know, anywhere in this region, we probably don't want to run our process anyhow, because the polymer is going to win on the bottom of the trench. So again, that's just an academic exercise. So considerations beyond the egg chart. So in the egg chart, what we did is we said we're going to look at these three parameters. We're going to look at chemistry and its interaction with bombardment and the impact of polymer. So basically, that's what we did in our exercise, but we didn't discuss some other major factors that impact our etch. And this would be residence time, microloading, the proximity effect, and then we're going to look at the post-etch evaluation. So the residence time, this is like your residence, like where you live. This is the average time gas is present in the chamber in seconds. The residence time is a balance of the pressure, the input gas flow, and the pump efficiency. Naturally, the residence time will impact the etch process because the etch chemistry and the byproducts are constantly being pumped away at a certain rate. So we could set a system for maybe a dry etch to 30 millitorr. And that gas, the average gas molecule, can sit in there for milliseconds or it could sit in there for minutes, depending on how we would actually input the gas and remove the gas from that chamber. So as we move the fresh gas and the volatile products out of there, naturally that's going to be part of our process. So a lot of the residual polymer comes from the volatile product. So the faster that you would get rid of that volatile product, the less polymer you would have on the sidewall. So this greatly increases, you know, the P in our exercise. Microloading. This is a term that refers to the change in a local etch rate relative to the whole area of material being etched. A large area will load the etching process done with volatile etch products, slowing down the etch in that area while smaller etch areas proceed at a faster etch rate. Etching rates change according to the pattern exposed area. So microloading is shown in this picture. If we have a large area here, shown geometrically by that blue area, we're going to say that this is too large of an area for the available chemistry. So we don't have enough chemistry to do that work, so we're lacking chemistry. That's the rate limiting step. Is we don't have enough chemistry. There's too many volatile products blocking that chemistry coming off that area. So that large area is going to etch rather slowly. Where if we look at a smaller area, we're going to have, at least in our estimation or this exercise, we're going to say that we have more than enough chemistry to do our work. So therefore, this will etch quicker. So for microloading, our basic premise here is, and this term would describe when large areas etch slowly and small areas etch rapidly. That's defined as microloading. So as we can see from this, or maybe draw the conclusion, when you would do a design of a product and you would manufacture a mask, if you would want to have the geometric shapes, the large ones and the smaller with geometric features to be at the same depth, they have to be relatively the same geometric size. So as you change the geometric, the width of a pattern, you're also going to impact often the depth of the resultant geometric shape. So microloading, large features etch slow, and smaller features etch quicker. This is contrasted by the exact opposite thing called the proximity effect. This is when, and this is again due to many variables, certainly the incoming chemistry and the size of the geometric shape. But we can look at it in this viewpoint. Well, we would look at the picture on the left. We would say that in a smaller geometric shape, it's difficult to get the etchant gas in to form a volatile product. And once we form the volatile product, it's crowded and has a difficult time being pumped out. So in this geometric shape, we're going to say the smaller one, the smaller geometric shape compared to this one, this smaller geometric shape etches slow. So if we were to give it enough room to get the fluorine in and the volatile products out, now the larger feature etches faster. So again, this constraint is all relative. So when we consider the proximity effect, and here, the smaller feature etches slower than the larger feature. And this is exactly opposite when we refer to the terminology of microloading. And again, this is dependent on, you know, the width of this geometric shape. And it's also certainly dependent on the chemistry, pressure, and other parameters that exist in our system. But, you know, the role here is you really can't say, does a smaller feature etch faster or slower than a larger feature? Well, it depends whether microloading is the dominant force due to your process parameters, or the proximity is the dominant force due to your process parameters. So there certainly would be roles depending on the different materials and chemistries that you can extrapolate for specific examples. But as a general rule, that's why we have two different terminologies called the microloading and proximity effect. They would describe these two different results. So etch evaluation, when we look at an etch, you know, our etch profile, three-dimensional etch profile in our substrate, we would look at, when we're looking at these parameters, we would look at the etch rate, the selectivity of the material, uniformity, certainly the sidewall profile, loss or gain of critical dimensions, corrosions, especially in metal etch, and in reproducibility. And again, in nanotechnology, probably one of the most important words is reproducibility. So we'll take a brief look now at, certainly a nice part of dry etching is the feature of endpoint detection. So endpoint, it's a general term describing when an etch process has finished. There's two common methods of detection. There's optical emission, which is very, very popular, and mass spec, which is certainly less popular. So optical emission, each volatile etch product emits a specific wavelength of light. The wavelength intensity shows the relative amounts of products being formed. A decrease in intensity corresponds to a decrease in etch products. So this is a optical endpoint detector system. This is mounted on a system that we have at Penn State University. What we have here is, this is an Oxford Instruments plasma lab, and this is about big as a loaf of bread or so, to give you a relative scale. And that's an optical system, and it's an interferometer. What that does is it has a band of light, and it interacts, of known light, and it interacts that destructively interferes with the light that comes from the plasma system. So what we would take is an optical system, an optical cable, and plug it into that viewport there. It would take that light and interfere that with the light that is produced with this optical system, and it would give us the relative amounts of light that exist, the light spectrum that exists in that plasma system. And again, that light is going to tell us the materials that exist in that plasma system. So what we're looking at is, this is the material to be etched, some common materials over here, and these are the etching gases that are used. And then what we can look at is the emitting species, and this is actually the color that would be shown from there. So, for example, what we could do is we could etch a layer of silicon dioxide and etch that layer of silicon dioxide maybe 500 angstroms deep, and then we hit a layer of silicon nitride. How do we know that we went on 500 angstroms and hit the nitride? Well, what we would do is we would look at these optical emissions. When we're looking at this silicon dioxide, we would be looking for, when we go through the silicon dioxide and hit the nitrogen, then we would be getting an emission of 337 nanometers. So once we see this 337 nanometer signal grow, we went through the oxygen part SiO2 and we've hit the nitride. So basically we're looking for these types of emissions. We can also look at the 674 emission band. So that's basically what we would do. I mean, typically I did this stuff before. We would look at, for this case, we would write a mathematical algorithm, on a computer that uses that, this system, this Oxford Plasma Lab System 100, this endpoint detector. We would write a software algorithm that would say, we're looking for oxygen as the oxygen peak goes down. So this would be the oxygen peak as 777 or 843 as that peak would go down. And as we would see the 674 peak emerge, then we would know that we were leaving the SiO2 material and actually etching into the nitride. So at a certain level, we would say etch for 5 more seconds, etc., in our software algorithm. And we would know that we etched all the way through silicon dioxide, hit the nitride layer, cleaned that up a bit, etched in there a little bit, and then we knew where we were. So that's the end point. So it's the end of one material and the beginning of another material. So this is the optical endpoint. And again, this might be for our normal etch. We were looking at oxygen level, and as our oxygen falls off, then we would know that we ran out of silicon dioxide and we were into our next material. It might be titanium, might be nitride, whatever it would happen to be. So mass spec, this method of endpoint detection measures the charge mass ratio of etched products. So certainly we discussed this type of characterization technique in the characterization portion of the NAC program. As the charge mass ratio peak declines, the product being generated by the etch declines due to the material being etched away. The RGA analyzer is a mass spectrophotometer. So let's look at this mass spec. And again, what this does is take ionized materials, puts it through a magnetic field, and what it's going to do is control that curvature. The one that has the appropriate balance in the magnetic field is going to be able to make it to the detector. So this is a mass spec of alcohol. And we do this, we look at mass spec of different materials in our labs as a training exercise for a student.